Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the podcast about anything and everything in the world of wrestling. Welcome to Such Good Shoot. I'm your host, Dozer, along here today with Isaac, BDJ, and our special guest, Dr. Tom Pritchard.
Guys?
Man, it is a pleasure to have you. Yes.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here, man. It's a great night to be anywhere, I guess, huh?
Sometimes it's just good to be alive.
Well, yeah. We emphasize the word sometimes on that, right?
Sometimes, yes. Yeah. Cool. Some mornings I don't feel that way, but usually at night I'm in a pretty good mood.
There you go.
you grew up in Texas. Is that basically synonymous with being a wrestling fan at that age time?
Yeah, I don't think so. In fact, I know for a fact, most of the kids during my time of growing up were always wanting to be astronauts or teachers or policemen and stuff. That was a stock answer from kids back then, even though they didn't know what the hell they wanted to do. But I watched wrestling, Bruce and I, my brother, we watched wrestling every Saturday afternoon. And you had the Funks, you had Ricky Romero, Gory Guerrero, you had Buddy Cold, Gorgeous George Jr., all these names who were top names back in the day, but we're watching it from day one. We fell in love with it. And then when we moved to Houston, it was the same thing. You'd meet some guys who say they wanted to be wrestlers if you went to the arenas, but as a usual occupation, when kids would be asked on these little kid shows and stuff, hey, what do you want to do when you grow up? I want to be a scientist. I thought, no, man, I want to be a wrestler. And it wasn't like it is today. It was a territory system. It was wrestling every single week. You had studio wrestling on Saturday or Sunday afternoon, right before roller derby. If you remember roller derby, roller derby, you'd be in your 60s as well. But the point is, that's gone by the wayside. That model doesn't exist anymore. But yeah, being in Texas afforded us to see some of the greatest wrestlers of all time. For that era, let me say this, from all time. But it was done differently, and it was authentic, it was real. And Texas wrestling, that's where the Texas death matches came about, because they just knew Texas was outlaw and the wild, wild west. And by God, it was. I got to see Terry Funk in his prime when he first started. Got to see Dory Funk Jr. Yeah, that alone was just worth the price of admission growing up. So Texas, while it wasn't the usual thing you'd hear come out of some kid's mouth, there were closet wrestling fans, but I was right up front about it. And so it was a lot of fun growing up. That's for sure. Even if nobody else wanted to be a wrestler, we sure did.
Well, I mean, and if you both wanted to get into that business, you sure as hell made it and have had a lot of success doing so. And I mean, How did you go about making it happen? I mean, you really started working in Los Angeles. How do you go from Texas out to California? And I guess, sort of piggybacking, I mean, you have those amazing territories and all those guys in Texas. Why? I mean, was it just harder to get into it there than it was?
I started taking pictures and writing stories for the wrestling magazines of the time. Wrestling News, it was a lot of Jim Melby and Norm Kite's publications. And those names are known to the real students of the game and the historians, but not to a lot of other modern wrestling fans. But we grew up in El Paso, moved to Houston when I was 10 years old, man. And we started watching Houston wrestling right away. And I was looking for a way in, because I knew there had to be an in. You don't just come in and say, hey, one night I want to be a wrestler. You got to work your way in. It really was a closed club back then. It was like the mafia. And I hate to use that description, but it was like the mafia.
Yeah, you got to start by running errands and going.
You got to start by being introduced to the right people. Yeah. And we used to go every Friday night, my mom, Bruce, and myself. And I wanted to take pictures at ringside. And Paul Bosch was the promoter. And I had this new Nikon camera when you still had to put film in it and things like that. Yeah. And I wanted to take pictures for the magazine and asked Norm Kitzer and Jim Melby if you could get me a press pass. I'm 12 years old by this time. And they sent me some kind of gimmick, you know, hey, with their magazine logo stamped on it. And my brother Ken, my older brother Ken, picked me up from school one day and said, we're going to go downtown and meet Paul Bosch. I thought, what? He goes, I called Mr. Bosch today and asked him if he would give you an opportunity to just meet with you and see if you could take pictures at ringside. I thought, wow. So that was the coolest thing I'd heard.
Wow.
We went into Paul Bosch. At that time, they had a wrestling office. You walk in, and it's like a museum with pictures of all the guys on the wall. And it was really, really cool if you're a wrestling fan, especially for that era. If you've never seen, or if you get the chance, the YouTube Friday Night in the Coliseum by Jeff Winningham. It's like a 40-minute short film, Friday Night in the Coliseum. Jeff Winningham, 1972. We were going to all the matches back then. It's in the office that you see Paul Bosch come out of in the very beginning is the office that I went to meet Paul in. Oh, wow. And I showed him this press pass, and I'm nervous, and he looks at it, and he says, well, how about an opportunity this Friday night? And I thought, wow, I get to take pictures at the main event Friday night. Sam Houston Coliseum, send them on to Jim and Norman. They'll publish them. And sure enough, Friday night came, and I was at ringside. And now I'm 12 years old at ringside when all the bumps take place, when the chops, when the forearms, and everything is happening. I'm watching, and I'm taking pictures, and Paul wants to see him the next week. Of course he does. He told me where to go to get enveloped. He had a guy named Fred Trube over on another street that did all his pictures. And so I brought him to him. He looked. He picked out the pictures he would send, and I sent those. They got published. Wow. And we were going every week to Houston. My mom, we started out in the cheap seats, and then there was somebody down in the ringside area that gave up their permanent reservations, and we got those because we were next in line. We sat behind a lady who was a friend of Paul's mistress at the time. She became his wife later on. And three ladies, they're sitting there talking all the same age, and just before, you know, the show and in between the intermissions, while Bruce and I are digging the matches and doing what we can do. So I'm start taking pictures, and Paul is now moving out of his office on 2022 San Jacinto at the corner of Gray. That's ingrained in my head. And he's moving to 1919 Caroline at the corner of Pierce. He gets me, and I think Bruce helped move the office from one place to another. So we moved all the pictures, everything else. So now we're not just going to the matches. I'm not just taking pictures, but I helped Paul Bosch move. Wow, it's a big thing. My brother Ken, again, got me a job that summer selling shoes at Montgomery Ward's. And I lasted 2 weeks, and I'm at the wrestling office picking up our tickets. And I'm telling the stories to the two ladies who work behind the counter that this is a horrible job. Oh, my God, the people that come in. And Paul is walking out of his office. And he stood there. Now, this is as I look back on this, too, it sounds incredulous and incredible, but this actually happened. He said, well, that job's going to give you a lifetime of stories. How would you like to work here? So when he said that, I said, oh, my God, of course. And I found a check last year. It was $75. That's what I was making a week for a kid during the summer. $75 a week. I'm living at home. I have no bills. I get to go to the matches from the office, I get to see Gary Hart and the guys come in Friday morning for the booking meeting. So now I'm working behind the office or behind the counter in the office. And I'm 15 years old at this time. I had a learner's permit to be able to drive. You could drive without somebody in the car for some amount of time, whatever it was. And that's pretty much what I got to sit by Paul Bosch at ringside every Friday night. There's a great match. There's a couple of matches I've seen myself at ringside down on the left-hand corner. If you look at Harley Race and Terry Funk, 1977, I'm sitting right there down the left-hand side. And I'm looking at this going, now here I am. I have the picture of Toro Tanaka taking a flying body press from Mil Moskowitz that Paul had in his office. Wow. And I have that picture on our wall at JPWA. I have the picture of me working in the office with that picture on the wall in the office. So that's kind of how it started, man. I mean, we loved it our whole life. We got in with it because we were at the right place at the right time.
And your older brother,
Ken. Yeah, it was Ken. Because of him. He was
God
he
bless really him. Was.
That's no, awesome. Awesome. Yeah, it really
that's
was awesome.
So cool. Do you remember what the main event was of the first match you took pictures of?
It was supposed to be Wahoo and Jack Briscoe. And something happened where Briscoe couldn't make it, or the match got screwed up because they had a substitute. And I remember Paul saying, "Are you ready to get the match you originally going to take pictures of?" Or something along those lines. I just remember him asking, "Are you ready?" Without me coming to ask him, he says, "Are you ready?" And give me another opportunity to get the main event that was supposed to be. So then it came back and I took Briscoe and Wahoo. And that was when, I don't know if you've seen the new NWA title book. But the old NWA championship, yeah, there was an NWA at one time that meant something. But with yes, Jack wearing the old title that Dory Funk Jr. had, because they had to take the new belt in, and right, and that's one of the rare pictures of Jack wearing the old NWA title from the night from 1959 in 1973. So, that was the main event, I believe, and then
wow.
It didn't happen, then you made it happen. So.
That's a wild place to start. And so you get out there. How did you transfer from, you know, sort of working under the tutelage there to ending up in Los Angeles and, you know, working with the LaBelles and training with them and sort of getting into the wrestling side of things?
Well, I'd always wanted to get in the wrestling side of things. Obviously I was working out with Mark Lewin in Houston as well and getting to know him a little bit, but Paul Bosch had actually called Don Owen in Portland and got me booked in there. And the night I was supposed to leave, or I'm sorry, the last Friday night before I was supposed to leave, Gary Hart came up to me and said, "You're starting in Fresno, next Wednesday." I said, "But Gary, I'm supposed to go to Portland first." He says, "No, you're going here first and stay there for 2 weeks and then go." Well, I didn't. I really should have known, but I didn't, and I just wasn't thinking about calling anybody and asking anybody because I figured everybody worked in concert together. Everybody knew Gary, you know, would always be at the office on Friday morning, and I just figured that would come up in conversation or whatever I thought back then. I was 20 years old, and I fly into Fresno. And I wind up there 2 weeks, and I asked Chavo, "When am I supposed to go?" Chavo Guerrero Sr. was the booker. And he says, "You're not going anywhere, man. You're staying here." And I thought, well, okay, great. I'm staying here. So I stayed there for a year, and I eventually made it to Portland in 1985. And Don Owen told me about that story that he was waiting for me to show up. 4 years later, here I am. So, yeah, that's how I wound up in LA. Thanks, Gary. He kind of diverted me off.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Holy shit. Damn, man. Yeah, that's oh, that's funny.
There's no mystery to it. I just got shanghaied. Thank you.
Yeah, that'll happen, I guess. When it came to wrestling and like learning that, who do you really credit with spending a lot of time like really getting you in ring shape and learning the like applying your trade?
Well, while working in the office in Houston as a teenager, again, mm-hmm. I worked there from the time I actually junior in high school that summer, the summer when after a senior year, then I started working every week. Various guys would come to the office and either talk to Paul and tell him they wanted to be wrestlers, or some of the guys wanted to come in and just hang out. There was a football player in Houston, and he wanted to transition to wrestling. He thought he'd heard from everybody else it was a pretty easy gig, or at least a lot more fun. Ernie Ladd and Ron Pritchard, some other guys who'd wrestled or played football, were also wrestled. And he thought, what the hell? If they can do it, he could do it. So the next week, Gary brought the Iron Sheik with him to the booking meeting, but really it was to meet this football player. And as you know, every smart, great professional wrestler always carries his gear with him. And I always put workout gear in the back of the car just in the hopes, dreams that something like this would happen. And Gary brought the Iron Sheik with him from Dallas, who's working the territories, Muhammad Farouk. And they wanted to go down the Coliseum workout. Paul says, you can take them, or you need to take these guys to Coliseum. And Ian Benny said, you can get in there if you'd like. Whoa. That was it. I was working at the wrestling office, but they weren't letting me back in the dressing room yet. And I was taking the jackets back sometimes, and I'd have to put them on a chair. There was another door, you know. So now I'm going to get to go in the locker room in the Sam Houston Coliseum, see what it's like. And I'm going to dress there. We're going to go out in the ring, and we're going to learn the art of professional wrestling. So we go into the Coliseum, get in the dressing room. We all have our gear. I get my gear out and tennis shoes and warm-ups and a t-shirt. The Iron Sheik, he doesn't get out his pointy boots. He gets out his amateur boots and his singlet. He becomes the Olympic Iron Sheik, the Olympic wrestling Iron Sheik, but about 245 solid pounds, mm-hmm. just in shape and hard. And
yeah, he was cut.
He was he big. Was
yeah.
And we go to the ring, and the first thing he says, okay, you'll go down to push-ups. And so the guy and I went down. I don't remember how we did. Then we did some squats, just got the blood pump, and he says, okay, now we're going to lock up. So he goes to me, he showed how to lock up. So he says, and I went too light with him the first time because I'm trying to show him I know this stuff. And he's going to show me, no, you don't. So he says, no, I want you to lock up strong. And he locked up. Good and strong. I said, okay. First time we went to the lockup for real, I lock up and I slap him right on his ear. Yeah, that's what I did too. And he just went, ugh. I did not say wham, and he slapped me. Right? I mean, and I don't know if he hit me as hard as he could, but if he didn't, I'm glad.
Yeah, it right. Was
pretty damn hard. But then he had me and the guy, who the football player, do some amateur stuff. He's trying to show us how you put your hands here, you put your leg here, you okay. Then he says, okay, you try to turn me on my back. Sheik is now getting on his hands and knees, and he's 245 pounds, and I'm a 160 at best. And I go to toss him, do whatever I can do, but he just turtles on me, and I can't do anything with this guy. So then he goes, now I do you. And I got on my hands and knees, and he stretched me to this day. I don't know what it was. But I used to scream louder, louder. I said, okay. And then he just pushed me aside. And I expected that. I mean, I really did. I was expecting if I'm going to get in there, it's part of the passage, the rite of passage. You're going to get stretched.
And yeah.
I mean, you got to pay dues. And I accepted it. But the football player came one more week, and that was it. He didn't like that stuff. And I think Sheik came maybe two more times, and then he left the territory. So beginning with the Iron Sheik, yes. But then there were two guys in Houston named Nick Kozak and Joe Mercer, also wrestled with Joe Pizza, and they had a record service. And on one side of the ring was – they had a ring in there, just dirty, grimy, dusty place. They had a – right on one side, a six-foot pit that if you roll out on that side of the ring, you're going to fall right into. And – King Parsons, remember King Parsons?
I don't.
Iceman King Parsons.
Iceman King Parsons, thank you so much.
From Dallas. DDJ is.
Yes. Well, then you'll appreciate this too. So King was driving a dump truck. I mean, a huge dump truck at the time. He would drive from work in his dump truck, park it outside the record service, and get in the train like for 3 hours a night. And this is what I was doing every night too for a while. And when King got his break, King had his first match in Texas, in Dallas. I mean, obviously in Texas, in Dallas. And it's going to be King Parsons, Nick Kozak, and me making the road trip to Dallas, go to the Sportatorium. I mean, it was famous wherever it was. It was the Sportatorium in the early 80s, or late 70s. It was 79, 78. On that very morning we're supposed to leave, my girlfriend at the time calls me crying. So what's wrong? Well, so my mom just had a heart attack. Wrong. Sorry to hear this. Yeah, we're on the way to the hospital now. I'll see you there. No, I'm going to go to Dallas with King and Nick. He's having his first match tonight. says, what? Yeah, I'm going to Dallas. And she hung up on me. We're not together anymore. So, yeah, whatever, man. But you know, I would say those definitely Nick Kozak, Joe Mercer, and Aaron Sheik. And then the rest of the time, I mean, with this business, it's like stand up or anything else. You have to do it in front of people to get better. Yeah. And you got to have people in the ring with you to call it and make sure and listen and tell you when to slow down. Because when you're young, you want to speed up and you think you're doing just right when you're not. You need to hear that. And a lot of people don't want to hear that. Good players want to be coached and great players want to be told the truth. Yeah. So, you know, there's not that many of those truth tellers out there today, I guess. So, but that was how those are some of the early influences that went on. I met others.
Those are some great influences. One thing that strikes me about you talking about, you know, starting out, just getting in as a photographer is, you know, that's very similar to how Jim Cornette got into it. You know, he was a ringside photographer. And I know
Paul Heyman, I think, the same way.
Paul Heyman, Eddie Gilbert.
Yeah, and I know DJ, you had a question about Cornette and working with him that you wanted to ask.
Yeah, so I was a huge fan of Smoky Mountain Wrestling, and I just remember discovering an accident. So a couple of what was it like having him as your manager during your time at Smoky Mountain?
Very cool. I've known Jim. I met him about a year, two years after I broke in. He's a really entertaining and good guy. And at Smoky Mountain, the whole thing was on him. He was like a one-man show. And he called me, offering me a position when there were no positions to be had. There were no opportunities to be had. I had been in Memphis at that time a little over a year, and my time was running out. I knew it. Everybody knew it. And he offered me a gig. And he didn't have to. There were other people who could ask. In fact, it was supposed to be the Midnight Express and Rock and Roll. So Stan needed a partner.
Oh, really? Wow, I never knew that.
Sure was. But Bobby got signed to a contract after Jim and Stan quit. Jim and Stan had had enough of WCW, and they just assumed Bobby was going to come with them. And he was, but they offered him an extension. They offered him another contract. And he had a family, and Jimmy said, no, stay here. You've got to take care of yourself. He'll figure it out. So Jim was great. Jim, I have nothing but love, respect, and admiration for Jim Cornette. He's been nothing but great to me. He is a stand-up guy for what he believes in. You know, I have to respect that. I have to respect anybody who has views of their own. And agree with him or not, he's passionate about how he feels.
The man is just a encyclopedia of wrestling knowledge.
Yeah.
Like, it's incredible, you know, like, and yeah, he's, you know, I mean, part of his thing is being Jim Cornette, and that's, you know, but.
Well, not just part of his thing. That's
Jim. That is.
He's tremendous. He knows how to tell stories. He knows which way to take it. If he wants to take you up, he'll take you up. He wants to take you sideways. That's him. The best performers are just an extension of who they are. They've got funny guys on stage are usually the funny guys off stage. And because it's a natural thing, it's second nature. And Jim, my God, he, the Midnight, Rock and Roll were certainly defined the 80s in WCW and tag team wrestling. And as far as what a top guy or top team really is. And How can you not at least respect it and honor it? You may not agree with it. You may not agree with a lot of things he says, but my God, at least he has the balls to say him. At least he stands for whatever he wants to stand for.
And he'll explain it. And he explains it. You know, it's not like he just takes like bullshit stances on stuff and then, you know, like has no real reason for why he does it. Like, he will go on, you know, a half hour rant if he has to, explaining in detail why he hates something. And yeah, I have a lot of respect for that because, you know, like you're saying, like if you think something and you're willing, it's an unpopular opinion, but you're still willing to go out there and say it. You know, like, that's not always the easiest thing to do when you're a public figure.
Yeah, but then really you have to care what people think about you for it to he doesn't care. He really doesn't care.
That's pretty cool. And then and then another question about your time in Smoky Mountain Wrestling. I know when you started out with the Heavenly Bodies, it was originally you and Stan Lane. And then I believe Stan Lane decided to retire, and then they brought in Jimmy Del Rey. Was there any difficulty for you to transition from partnering with Stan to Jimmy?
I think the difficult part was just being who I was at the time. Jimmy and I were two different people, and we had different ways of looking at things. In the ring, it was great. In the ring, Manny was a fantastic worker, no doubt. Outside the ring, this was Jimmy's, I think, first opportunity to really be in a good spot like that. And Kevin Sullivan is the guy who recommended him. That's why he came in,
okay,
pretty much sight unseen. So, pardon me, nobody had any issues, never had any issues with his work inside the ring. Never had any issues really backstage with him. But when we would go out, Jimmy liked to let everybody know, you know, just, hey, we're here, hey, great, and a little louder than that, obviously. But I didn't like to be so loud when I was going places a lot of times. I wanted to kind of slink in or walk in, survey the landscape. I don't know why. I'm just telling you how I felt at that time. Survey the landscape and either stand up over here, sit down over there, watch this going on over there, and yeah, listen to what's going on over here. And Jimmy wanted the whole bar to know when we walked in, hey, we're going to make as much noise as we can. And I'm more a little low-key, I think. And so I wasn't really – you know, we went out a couple times, and so I found out. I was like, dude, I mean, that's fine, but – I just don't really want to be around that. So it wasn't a hard time transferring as far as partners. It wasn't even a hard time outside so much because Stan and I, we socialized maybe once or twice, but you know, we both, again, were different people. And in that time in my life too, I was very much a loner, and why I couldn't tell you, but that's the way it was.
I can understand that. I feel that. That's my way. That would drive me nuts. I'd be like, hey man, I have a little bit of anxiety in public places. I don't really want to like just jump right in.
And I had right to have anxiety.
Let me dip my toes in the pool before I jump in. Okay. I'm curious about, I mean, you know, you were really lucky. You've been able to perform and wrestle in all these different, you know, like decades and under different, like with different styles and just as a different almost entity, you know, like, so you get to wrestle in the territory days and then you're getting to wrestle in the Attitude Era. And, you know, there are some things like, you know, you had that are like, sort of similar, you know, you had your that angle with Tony Anthony, you know, the dirty white boy thing, which, you know, like caused a lot of controversy at the time. And then, you know, like, and it was very similar to some of the stuff, you know, that was going on in the Attitude Era that again was like, you know, like trying to stir up controversy. And I'm just curious as like, you know, that like that's a similarity, but like there's so many contrasts in the business from, you know, like the late 70s and 80s to the 90s and now into today. And I guess where I'm going is, do you think that there's a difference between, you know, the professional wrestling that you sort of grew up on and were trained in and transitioning now into something that's more sports entertainment? Or do you think it's just, you know, like the natural evolution of it?
I don't know if anybody can tell what would be the natural evolution, but I will say that the culture's changed. The world has changed. You know, we didn't have cable TV in the 60s, 70s. It started to come in, and then 80s, it was really when it was the floodgates were open. But, you know, I think about it like this. And are we on a time schedule here, by the way?
I mean, whenever you want to get done, man, we can be done. But no, we're
because I have a story to tell that's kind of, to me, kind of sums up the different culture and the different attitude.
Yeah, we'll go as long as you want, man.
Well, I'm just saying. Sometimes my story can be a little long-winded.
Please, please.
Okay, okay. So here's the deal.
We're here to listen.
Well, then you better be sorry for that. So anyway, when I was growing up, Harley Race was in El Paso, and so was Grizzly Smith. And Grizzly Smith, when he made his debut, came out on TV and said, "You can punch me as hard as you can in the stomach. You can kick me. You can do anything you want. And just hit me in the stomach, but you won't hurt me." So they have some guys come out and punch him, and they say, "I don't care if you climb up that turnbuckle. Go ahead, come off the turnbuckle and just jump on my stomach as hard as you can." All right, they do that. Couldn't hurt him, couldn't faze him. So this goes on a couple weeks. I'm not sure how long, but a couple weeks at least. And Grizz is on a promo and says one day, "Look, you can come off the turnbuckle. You can come off the roof of your house. You can come off an 18-foot ladder. I don't care what it is. You can't hurt me." So the very next week, Harley Race comes out and says, "Hey, I got my 18-foot ladder. Where are you, you coward? Get out of here." And you don't call anybody a coward. And especially in Texas at that time. It's in a studio. It's a really close audience. And people, you know, the old comeback when people say wrestling's fake, Nick Kozak used to say, "Well, for those who believe, no explanation is needed. And for those who don't, no explanation will do." Because you still had your people who believed. You still had your people who wanted to cheer the good guy and boo the bad guy. And you had some people who just really believed, because those guys, when they would come to the ring, they really believed. They had the attitude and they had the vibe and they were authentic and they were real when they came to the ring. Of course, they were working, but they were thinking shoot. So you have to think shoot, but work. Nobody really understands that until they get in that position. They've been working a few years and they go, "Oh, now I get it," because they're clicking with the fans. But I digress. So Harley says, "I got my ladder. Where are you, coward?" And Grizz comes out the next segment and says, "Oh, I'm right here. And by God." So Harley has a couple guys holding the ladder, and he climbs up on the top of the ladder, and Grizz is laying prone on the mat. And the two guys are supposed to be holding the ladder to steady it for Harley. And Harley goes way up in the lights and he adjusts the lights and gets up there and he dramatic pause. And the TV announcer was Nick Adams, Baby Dolls, or Nick Roberts, I'm sorry, Baby Dolls' dad. And he says, "All right, ladies and gentlemen, we need complete and utter silence so Harley Race can concentrate getting on the ladder." So he gets up there and all of a sudden, silence, ladies and gentlemen. All right, he's messing with the lights and he gets poised, and he jumps off the ladder and comes with his knee right across Grizz's neck. And oh my goodness, the place erupts. And Nick Roberts goes, "Oh my goodness, ladies and gentlemen, oh no, what's happened?" And Grizz has his tongue hanging out. It's dramatic. And the two guys are scrambling, what the hell did they do? And Harley comes over to Nick, and Nick says, "What did you do? Why did you do this?" "It wasn't my fault. There were two geeks in the ring." And he's smiling. You know he's a liar. And Nick Roberts goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, we need," and this word always stuck with me too, "we need an ambulance," not an ambulance, an ambulance. In the studio, they had the roll-up door. They had an ambulance. They got everybody to the ring to check on Grizz. He's selling it. It's great. They get the ambulance. They put him on a stretcher. His tongue's hanging out. They strap him in. And, oh, my God, ladies and gentlemen, what's going to happen? Grizzly Smith's career is coming to an end. Oh, will he ever return? All this stuff. 2 weeks later, we're moving to Houston. My dad got a better job. We're leaving El Paso to go to Houston. I'm emotionally fully invested in what's going to happen to Grizzly Smith and this angle in Houston, in El Paso. All these crazy things are going on. And we have a lady in El Paso who's going to send us the newspaper and the card and all the advertisements. Back then, it was just newspaper, not this internet stuff.
Yeah.
It was even less reliable than today. But the point is, she's going to send me, keep me up to date. And in the newspaper clippings, they would always mention maybe in one sentence something about Grizzly Smith is recovering wherever he was from. We moved to Houston. We see new group of wrestlers, new crew, Wahoo McDaniel, Johnny Valentine, the great Malenko, Jose Lothario. At the time, Fritz Von Erich. We're watching these guys. Well, we're there, I don't know, 2 months, whatever it may be. We hear on watching the show on Saturday night. They had the matches Friday and replay on Saturday, except for the main event, and Sunday morning. On a Saturday night Houston wrestling card, we hear Paul Bosch say, "Returning next Friday night, ladies and gentlemen, to gain revenge on Johnny Valentine for dropping his bionic elbow across his throat is Grizzly Smith." That'll be in the main event. That had just happened in El Paso. And we get the letter, or I get the newspaper clippings the next week. It says, "Returning to El Paso, Grizzly Smith versus Race in grudge battle." And they went through the angle there, too. So they showed the angle on Houston Wrestling, and it shows Johnny coming off on the neck and all the stuff. Then I remembered what was happening. So that was about 10 years old, and I kind of was putting two to two together. But I still admired and was thoroughly mystified, if you will, with the way these guys went about protecting the work. You could do the same angle in the same state in a different city without everybody knowing about it. See, today, the internet would be out like Harvey. It would be done. So that's what a lot of the difference was and the culture was. And the guys also were made of a different type of metal, quite honestly. They looked like the people they were not portraying, but the people they were portraying, they were just turning up the volume. But there was unpredictability there. You couldn't say this guy is something other than what he was. Johnny Valentine was a rough, tough bastard who just, he really was that guy. He looked the part. He was the part. He wasn't playing a part. Yeah. He was that guy.
And no one was writing lines for him. No one's creating anything.
Right. It's all their thoughts. It's all their feeling. It's all their emotion. And that's missing today because no one's actually seen that in action with the kind of people and players you need for that to have happen. They don't exist anymore. It's a different world. Wrestling has always been entertainment. But you always, not always, but up until about late 70s, 80s, because that's when everybody started getting into it. And when I say everybody, it's like there used to be a process where you had to know somebody who knew somebody to get you in. And if you didn't have that, you were called an outlaw. They weren't called independent wrestlers back then. They were called outlaws. Because usually what would happen, if you couldn't get into onto the regular promotion, you would start your own gimmick and find a building or a place to work and set up a ring and compete. Not really in Houston. Houston, they had outlaws, but they couldn't compete with Paul Bosch because Paul had TV. He had better talent. But these guys still wanted to be wrestlers and want to be famous and tell everybody they're wrestlers. So, but you can't always trust words because people can tell you everything. You trust actions because that speaks for itself. And these guys' actions, by not going to the gym, by not looking like wrestlers, pretty much exposed everything. And the other thing was the commissions were strangling a lot of these. Just that, and that's why I believe Vince went out and came out and said, "Look, we're not going to insult anybody's intelligence." And as soon as he said that, as soon as Vince says, "We're not going to insult anyone's intelligence, what we're doing is showbiz, it's sports entertainment," it went through the roof because you had Austin, you had Mankind, you had Hunter, you had Triple H. I already said Triple H, but you had these guys who looked the part, who went to the gym, who were these badasses, and who, if they weren't the badasses, you'd be surprised. You know, Mick Foley was a kind, gentle guy, but he was Mankind. You know,
right? Yep.
You got to work with, speaking of Steve Austin, you got to work with him in a stable in the USWA, right?
Yeah. It was a Texas stable. Sure.
I mean, and at that point, did you know, were you like, this guy is like, has got something special, or was it just like, he's another guy that you're working with who's got some talent, but like, you know, is in a group with a lot of talented people?
Well, you knew Steve was going to be a top guy. You knew, when I say you, I mean the boys and most of the fans could tell he didn't belong in the first match. He was destined to be a top guy, but I don't believe anybody, including myself, could have told you he was going to be as big as he was. He looked the part. He was the part, but he was stunning Steve Austin. He was the Hollywood Blonde Steve Austin. He was a ringmaster Steve Austin. He was the Stone Cold. You have to try a bunch of stuff. throw it against the wall, keep what works. So not everything's going to be a home run. But, pardon me, with Austin, he knew what he wanted, and he was relentless, his drive to get it. And that's what it takes. It takes confidence. It takes having a vision. It takes believing it can happen, where you actually manifest it to happen. And that's the only other way to explain it, is they kept going until they got what they wanted. You know why the rain dance works? It's because they don't stop dancing until it starts raining. You don't quit, it'll eventually happen.
So, and, I guess another person like that is The Miz, right? I mean,
by all means, yeah.
I mean, he's a guy who's like, I want to do this. And like, against all odds,
against all odds, against everybody's opinion, against everybody's feelings towards him, against everybody's misconnection or misperception. He and said, now, I don't care what you think. Yeah, I don't care what you think. I'm going to go through with it because I can, I will, and I believe. And Miz is doing a great job, not only on wrestling, but his reality series, Dancing with the Stars. He's transcended to, and he knows, but he does that. He's one of the hardest working guys at WWE. He's ready, willing, and able to do whatever it takes. And he also understands how to manipulate and maneuver, which is a key attribute. If you don't have that, you're going to be manipulated and you're going to be maneuvered. So it's better to learn the other part first.
What was, I mean, you spent some time training him, right?
Yeah, a little bit. He was out of Deep South when I got in, I think. No, I've had some dealings with him, and he's always been great to me. I understand those kind of people. When I say that, he's a natural smartass, but he also understands when to put a pause and then return back to being a smartass. And that's another element a lot of people don't get. So that's why I think he's so successful today.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, yeah, he's really got something special with his ability to, you know, at the same time draw you in and also piss you off.
That's a talent. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he has legitimate heat.
Yeah.
So, you know, but that's authenticity.
Yeah.
That's what's missing.
But you want to watch him.
Of course.
When it comes to training, I mean, you know, you've trained a lot of really incredible talents. One of the things that I've noticed is that you've trained a lot of second generation and third generation wrestlers, you know, or people who've been in the business. You know, you got, you know, I mean, The Rock, Randy Orton, you know, guys like that. Is there a difference in training a guys like that versus somebody who, like, you know, I mean, for The Miz, for example, or, you know, like, it's a guy who wants to do it but doesn't have the family heritage, isn't like sort of born into the business. Is it easier to train a second generation wrestler, or is it harder because they have their own preconceived notions coming in of what they should be doing?
It really varies. I've had some really great second, third generation guys that I've crossed paths with and been in the ring with, but everyone is really different. Randy and Rock, name some others, because I know those two guys especially.
I mean, Shane McMahon, another guy. Oh, who's, you know,
well, he's in that category with Rock and
I mean,
Randy. I mean, so here's the deal. Sometimes I have preconceived notions, and other times, even though their preconceived notions are solidified in their head, they don't have a clue.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay too. The guys that I run into who might have been trained a little bit prior to will have their own way of going into a front face lock or a hammer lock or whatever it may be. There's this way, that way, there's your way, there's my way, but the right way and the only way does not exist on how to teach someone how to do this. It's a feeling business. It's an entertainment business. You have to have some second natured movement. You just got to don't do it until you get it right. Do it until you can't get it wrong, until the second nature to you just stepping in the ring. So many guys will lock up and grab a headlock with your right arm. Incorrect. Don't grab a headlock with your right arm. But they don't get it. It doesn't feel foreign to them yet until mm-hmm. you do it over and over and over and over and over and repetition, more repetition.
So you get muscle.
You just can't do it wrong. Then that's that issue. That's the point we're trying to make. This mm-hmm. isn't for everybody. This is a feeling business. It's like playing a guitar. You can stand there on stage and play the guitar, or you can hunch over, or you can bend it this way, or you can do a little movement with it and feel it, or you're just going to stand there and play the song. It's the same thing in wrestling. Are you going to do the moves over and over, boring, and no body language, no facials, no nothing, pacing in between the gaps, all these little things that nobody thinks about? It's the details that make up the difference. Mm-hmm. It's the part in between the moves. It's everything you do in the ring, everything you do even before you get to the ring. It sets the mood, sets the table. And a lot of people don't want to take the time to understand that or even learn it or even hear about it today. I get it all the time because I tell people right at the beginning of our course, if you've had any training whatsoever, please don't be showing people outside the ring. You're paying to learn from me right now. If someone comes in or you go somewhere else and they ask you to do it a different way, do it their way. You're now listening to them. There's not just one way to do this. But while you're with me, I want you to do it my way so everybody is on the same page. Mm-hmm. If you can do it better and it's more comfortable this way and it's safe for you and your opponent, great. But I know what the safe way is right now. And I know the basics and fundamentals never go out of style in anything. Baseball, football, basketball, mm-hmm. wrestling. You're still trying to score a touchdown. You're still trying to hit a home run. We're still trying to win the match. We're still trying to get the people over. We're still out there entertaining. But if you don't know how to lock up, if you don't know how to circle, if you don't know when to stand, if you don't have your footwork down first, you're not going to make it.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, you have your fundamentals. And DJ, yeah, I know you had a couple of questions about training
So again, Isaac mentioned The Rock, Randy Orton, Shane McMahon. You also were known for training like Val Venus and Kurt Angle. And obviously, Kurt Angle would go on to do so much in the business, did you expect like Kurt Angle to become as great as he ended up?
Because I've been asked that before about even asking about Austin or Rock. Mm-hmm. But Kurt, especially being a gold medalist, I didn't have a clue. Most amateur guys don't make it very far in wrestling, professional wrestling, right. Because it's so foreign to them to be on their back or to have to show pain. They're doing everything opposite of what professional wrestling is. But when I locked up with Kurt for the first time, I told him before we locked up, I have nothing to prove to you, so don't take me down. Don't even try that, please. Please, please, please. You're the greatest in the world. Fantastic. Great. Good job. But when I first locked up, he had it. He knew it. He understood it. And I don't think it's because of what I said to him. He instinctively understood this is completely different. He watched wrestling a little bit, I think, with ECW and maybe somewhere else. But, yeah, so when we got him in the ring – he was more than accommodating. He got it. He was confident in who he was. He won the gold medal with a broken freaking neck. So he wasn't afraid of some guy. He wasn't afraid to be vulnerable because he understood he was performing. And I didn't know he was going to be that good at performing. I didn't realize he was going to be that great at performing and doing what he did, not only in the ring but on promos. He became very much in love with professional wrestling, and he understood it. It's a different element that he wanted to conquer, and he did. So yep. I think anybody I trained, I don't think I could have ever stood up and said, he's going to be a world champion, or he was going to be the greatest of all time, or he's going to be one of the biggest mega superstars, not just in wrestling, but on the planet. I mean, yeah, I don't right. think anybody, yeah, anybody could say that, because when you're one-on-one with these guys, they're just like us. They're fans of the business. Mm-hmm. They love the business. And the guys like the second generations, like the Rocks or the Austins even, or the Randys, they know the history of the business, and they realize this is a tough gig. And if you don't like it, it's even tougher. So you have to really love it to be great. And you have to really love it, I think, to succeed. You could do it the other way and not succeed, but your life won't be as fulfilling or happy, in my opinion. So, but yeah, I thought Kurt was going to be another top guy. I didn't know he's going to be as successful as he was either. I don't know of anybody that did, really.
One thing with Kurt is, as you know, I mean, just as a fan watching, and you know, the amount of time, you know, that, you know, from when he decided, you know, when he got signed and to when he debuted and started wrestling was relatively short. I mean, did he just take to it like a fish to water? I mean, it really seems like that, you know, like once, like, you know, like you just show him once, or he can watch sign. I mean,
he was very coachable.
He hit the ground running.
Yeah, he did. And he was around some really good top guys too that wanted to help him along. Not in the beginning, I think. I think he I don't know. I don't want to speculate either. But he did take to it, and he was able to see something or pay attention to something and implement it if he wanted to. So yeah, Kurt was a great, great coachable person to be in the ring with, and he would listen. And he understood what was going on and what we were trying to accomplish. Yep. And every time he went out to the ring, I thought he had a great work ethic, and he was great to have backstage too.
Well, I guess that's one thing. You know, I work at a boarding school with skiers, with elite skiers that train for the U.S. ski team in Olympics and stuff. And, you know, I think one of the things that I guess just sort of pops into my head is that, you know, if you get to that level as a professional athlete, it doesn't really matter what you're doing. You know, you look at a guy like Mark Henry, you look at him, I mean, Brock Lesnar, if you're operating at that high of a level in a professional sports capacity, you have to be coachable. You know, you have to have a willingness to learn, and you have to be able to take direction. And I guess, you know, I can see how that translates into being a good student in something new.
Well, sometimes it even comes down to being a good human being, because a lot of people don't know how to be good human beings. And some of us, it takes us a while to learn the qualities of what a good human being is supposed to be.
Especially in that business.
And you're right, 100%. So, I mean, you don't know if this guy who's won a gold medal, you may have talked to him once or twice, but you really don't know how he's going to operate until he gets on the road full time. Right. And yeah, you certainly have to have a work ethic. You have to have a mindset. You've got to have confidence, no doubt. But just don't let it get twisted to where you're thinking one thing, but reacting another way. In other words, don't think that this is going to be a breeze, and then get out there and not be able to react, not be able to connect, and not be able to follow what's happening in the ring and outside the ring.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then what kind of one other follow-up question that, if you don't mind, was there anyone that you ever trained that you thought was going to be something special, and then just for some reason, one reason or another, it just didn't work?
Yes. No names.
I was going to say, I'm not going to ask you to name names because I don't want you to call anyone out, but I
wanted to ask, but you already said
no. No. I know you wanted to ask, but yeah, there's been a couple, and yeah, that I really thought, one in particular, I really thought, this looks great. This guy has everything they're looking for except a brain. So,
yeah.
That was the like, dude,
I have my own.
Can
thoughts.
You be that stupid? And it was evident. Yes, you could. And then some. The bonus was you could also go past that line.
So. Yeah. Oh man.
Let me ask one question here.
No, go for it, man. Go for it, please.
So, You talked about how the old school mentality is a little bit different than how modern guys are taking it. Is there anybody currently you see who might have that old school mentality about them?
I love FTR. Those guys, yeah, they have an old school mentality. They know how to tell a story. They can get their point across. And you have, look, even if, and I could be saying this wrong because I'm looking through my eyes, but even if you're a casual wrestling fan, if you watch their matches, their tag matches, they have a flow and a story to them. I think it might be 80s style, no doubt, but it's not necessarily what moves they do. It's how they do the moves mm-hmm. they do and what they do in the space in between the space in between. So I think FTR is a great tag team. As far as anybody doing old school stuff, I haven't seen Impact in so long. I don't know anything.
No one has. That's a problem.
Yeah. I don't know about Ring of Honor. I don't know about a whole lot of the other stuff. But
have you seen much of Walter?
Yeah. I think now Walter's very good. Walter's that classic big man ass kicker.
He's one of those guys that I get that old school feel from. I mean, and he works a slightly newer style, but his, like, the way he carries himself, like, feels like you could put Walter in the 80s and he would fit in just fine.
But that's what I'm saying. Would that style even sell today? Because it is a different culture. You got back in those days, Andre the Giant was a touring attraction. We had three network channels, maybe a UHF. Now you've got so many options to watch and look at. What is going to make you watch wrestling today? I ask people this all the time. Why would you want to watch wrestling, and what would get you to want to be a wrestler these days? Is it Orange Cassidy? Is it Impact or All Elite Wrestling? No. It's certainly not what I was raised on, what I got into. It's not the same business, but the world's not the same either. Time keeps going on, and we can't stop it. So if that's what, you know, I remember as a kid growing up in the 60s and 70s, and I loved rock and roll, man. Who didn't? But you know, my dad didn't. He didn't like it. I'm not the demographic they're going for. So if the demo they get loves it, more power to them. And I'm glad. I didn't think they'd last this long. But I underestimated their willpower and their work ethic. I really did. I didn't think they were going to last a year. But it's another place for talent to go. But is it what people want to see? Do they want to see the Walters? Do they want to see the old school guys? If it's done well with people who look the part, I believe yes, but there's not a lot of people who look the part. We had a guy named Ox Baker. Have you ever seen Ox Baker?
I've heard of him. Yes.
Okay. Look at a picture of him. Look at a picture of him. He's just the mustache. He looks like a bad villain. Yep. He looks like a bad guy. You know, there's no mistaking. And he wrestled. He was a horrible worker, but he had this image, this persona. So he was a badass. In other words, he looked, if you asked him what he did, he didn't work at Kmart. He didn't work, you know, at Costco or the 7-Eleven. He was a professional wrestler. He was an ass kicker, but he could barely move. You know, he wasn't that great. So what they did is they gave him things he could do well, and those are all the things he did. It's the stuff in between is what made it different, and that's what a lot of people don't understand today. They think they have to do more moves than they actually really have to do, and then it becomes what's known as a cluster.
And
the point is, if you can't tell a story, then what are you trying to do? Just go out and do moves to impress yourself or impress the guys in the back? Well, that's great, but in the end, what's the end game? I don't know. If you tell a story, it's more interesting.
Do you think that people are asking that question backstage at WWE and at AEW these days? What do people want to see, or do you think it's
I mean, and is it more like them saying, this is what people want to see?
Well, I don't know. I really don't know if they're asking that question or not, but they will certainly be asking the question, why did we have more eyeballs on our product? And that, I guess, is another way of saying, what do we need to do to have people interested in what we're doing? So you have to have interesting people. You have to have interesting and compelling storyline. It used to be one booker. Now it's over, 40, 50 writers?
Something like that.
I understand. Once again, it's not old school wrestling. And I know WWE hates old school wrestling. It's because it's story-driven. It's fantasy-driven. Or I'm not even sure who's driving anymore. So some of these things should be evident that if they don't want to see what they're seeing now or what some people are seeing now, what is it? What's the recipe to get more people to get interested? You know, again, business was down long, long time ago. And right before the Attitude Era, business was at an all-time low. I don't know if it was all-time low, but it was down, man.
Yeah, 95 was not a great year.
Not a great year at all. No. And suddenly you had the emergence of a Stone Cold. He went from being this guy to that guy.
Yeah.
And it was authentic. It was real. And he connected with people. But you have to ask yourself, he was a bald-headed guy with a goatee, mustache, black trunks, black boots, black knee pad, black vest, as black and white as you could get.
Yep.
But yet the hottest baby face, the hottest heel they had.
Yep.
So, you know, you had Rocky Maivia come out smiling with the chia pet haircut, and they turned on him because they knew he was being shoved down their throats.
Yep.
And when Rock would hear it in the arenas, he would come backstage and say, why are they booing me? Well, I don't understand. So he thought about it. He says, it's because. And he came to the conclusion himself, I'm being shoved down their throat. It's not natural. It's not organic. And when he turned on the people and the fans and said, I've done everything I can, and all I hear is die, Rocky, die. You don't appreciate me. And he turned into who he is. He's a great smartass. He has great wit. He's got great comebacks. And he's charming. He's got a great smile, yes. But at that young age, no, they were trying to do it overboard.
Yeah.
Once Rock realized it, and once everybody else realized it and said, be yourself, go ahead, do it. He did. And so that a lot of authenticity, a lot of unpredictability is missing because everybody's in. Everybody knows, oh, ha, 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 this is what it is. I don't know if that's killing it. They knew it when Austin was going out there. But The Undertaker still got over, and Kane still got over. The guys that got over were the real deal.
And I guess that goes back to, and I mean, we'll wrap it up here because, you know, I know you've been at a birthday party. And
I have been at a huge birthday party. Let me just tell you, we have so many balloons there and little Bluey cups. I don't know if you know what Bluey is.
Bluey.
That's my son's favorite show.
Of course.
Yeah, so we all got
kids. My daughters.
Got exhaustion I'm feeling.
Sure. We all got kids, yeah. Yeah.
There you go. I mean,
when Vince McMahon sort of kicked off the Attitude Era and it's like, we're not going to insult your intelligence anymore. Have we gotten back to the point where it is like we're just sort of insulting the audience's intelligence and, you know, by saying, oh, well, this is so-and-so, this is their name that we made up. Even though you know who this is, you know that there's a real story behind this person. I mean, you look at them bringing, Steiner's son in and giving him a new name and not acknowledging the fact that, you know, and it's like, we know. I mean, you know, we have the internet. We know who these people are. And so it's like you're trying to, you know, bring a form of kayfabe back while at the same time say, oh, you know, we're... And it just feels kind of confused. And it does feel like you're getting back to the point where it is like almost like we just expect you to believe whatever we tell you.
I don't know if it's that so much as once you come to our domain in our environment, this is our domain and our environment. And we are going to make you this persona, this character, this storyline entity, I guess, and make it a series or make it a sitcom, because it's not wrestling. It's not. I don't go to, you're not going to WWE for wrestling. You're going to WWE for an action series. You're going to WWE for a sitcom series. You're going to WWE because these, if you're flicking the channel, or first of all, young people don't watch TV. They watch their devices, their phone. They don't. I know that. I get it. So they're not playing to the guys who watch them. They're not playing to the internet. They're not playing. It used to be until recently that you brought more internet darlings in because you were trying to play and get the internet on your side. Okay. That may work in the long, in the short run. But obviously, in the long run, Vince or whoever's making decisions right now sees it their way. And their way is running a billion-dollar company and making more money for their stockholders than they are worrying about making it more wrestling. They're going to make it more entertainment, if anything. They're going to make it more about the presentation. They're going to make it more about our stockholders and corporations. And will Vince ever sell? I find that a little bit hard to believe he would. But anything can happen in mm-hmm. WWE and anything in life. So, yeah. You know, really,
anything can happen.
Anything can happen. That's true.
God, I miss Vince McMahon on commentary and that voice.
Yeah, but that voice left him a few years ago.
Yeah,
it's true. And a few things left him years ago too. So we've got to figure out a way. But they are not the nitwits people are saying, but that's because very few people really know and understand what's happening. And that's the main concern is it is a billion-dollar company. It's done – man, he has surpassed anything done in wrestling before. Well, how do you go back to the simpler days of let's make it easier to understand unless somebody comes along? I mean, it has to be a group of guys. Somebody comes along and wants to go back that way, and people start asking for that way. And mm-hmm. MMA, UFC, things like that are what people are really into, it seems like today.
And I think that's a really you know, interesting point, because I feel like with UFC especially, they are the guys who are the closest to the old school wrestling business in a lot of ways, because it, you know, like there is that sense. You have Conor McGregor who can talk anybody into a building, you know, right. And like it almost doesn't matter. Like the fights don't even matter that much.
Well, you saw the last fight with Poirier, right?
I didn't watch that. No, I
anybody here watching? No. Okay. Well, no. They did a great angle where he broke his leg right at the bell. That's the kind of angles that wrestling used to do, professional wrestling.
Yep.
I mean, even, but it looking like they're pummeling each other, sometimes they would, and sometimes it would turn into that, even though they were working still. Nobody's getting mad about it, because if you hit somebody game a hard way in front of the fans, they believed it too, and they got into it. Now you have UFC doing the same thing pretty much, but at the end of the, at the buzzer, the bell, whatever it was, when I watched it with, with Danny Cage and his crew in it was actually in Boston with Caleb Seltzer. It went to Hooters and watched it. It came on late.
My neck is the woods.
We're watching. It's the first round, and we're seeing McGregor get his ass kicked, come up, and then the breaking of the foot at the bell. It was so
I saw that highlight. Oof.
It was just timed out so great. Even though it was a shoot, you don't know. Only they know. But he did break his leg for real. Well,
yes.
Greg Valentine broke Wahoo McDaniel's leg, you know, and all this other stuff. So it was like we're watching this going, this is what wrestling used to be. You had guys who could talk. You had guys who could talk smack. And then even after the match, when McGregor is laying up against the cage, it's the visual. And Joe Rogan goes in, and he's still yelling at Poirier. Say, tell your wife to call me. Hey, tell her. Great. I mean, it's all showbiz, but that's what it used to be. Wrestling's always been.
And you believe that, and you look at those guys and you're like, yes, those guys could whoop my ass.
Yes. And that's a huge element that I don't think is on the table anymore. I think everybody's looking more at the theatrical aspect. It's always had a theatrical aspect to it. It's never been a complete shoot.
Sure.
But there have been times where it was more of a shoot than it wasn't. And is really more real than people want to believe. So.
Yeah, and there's definitely a time where, you know, the people who were involved in it, you know, a big part of it was that you were tough. You were big and tough, and you weren't a gymnast. You weren't flipping as much. And I feel like because there's a lot of guys, like a guy like Ricochet, like I think is incredible. Like I love watching him work, but like, you know, his style is completely different from traditional, like, grab.
Well, yeah. I don't know if we need to go back to traditional. There's a guy named Ricky Starr who was a ballet guy, and mm-hmm. but he was also a tough wrestler. So it was one of those shooter guys, and he used to get in fights in the ring with guys who would be making fun of him and wouldn't put him over because he was too small and he did the ballet stuff. And then he'd get to tie him up. You know, so I mean, but even though the guy had a gay gimmick was a heel, and if the guy acted effeminate, he was automatically booed and it was mm-hmm. a heel, as opposed to today. That's what I'm saying. The culture's changed. A lot of the characters, we couldn't do Nazis today. We couldn't do the woke culture, the cancel culture.
Even the Big Boss Man's original uniform would have gotten.
You could do that today. So a lot of things we could do back then that is obsolete. We just can't do it today. If somebody came in and did it well and convincingly, I don't think you'll ever get. And there were never 100% believers anyway. There were always those 70-30 people who thought, you know, this is or this isn't. And then you had the people who thought, oh, the early matches are all fake, but that world championship, but man, that's a real deal.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So. Awesome. Well, I really – oh, yeah, you got some.
Yeah, I've got like two more questions before we let him go. This first one kind of got me thinking when you were talking about FTR and their old school mentality. What are your thoughts on MJF?
I love MJF. I think he's tremendously talented. I think once he's done wherever he's going to be, he's already on the radar. So mm-hmm. it's just a matter of time. It's just a matter of when, not if. For him, he's certainly got talent. I just hope he stays healthy and keeps his mind fertile and healthy along the way too, because it's real easy to fall into into the darkest depths of hell in your head.
Yes, I'm sure.
Yeah. And then my last question is there someone that like you're watching, say either on Monday or any night of the week, because there's wrestling every night of the week. Someone that like you see out there that you kind of think to yourself, man, I wish I could have trained him.
Well, I was talking about Zicky Dice maybe last year, 2 years ago, something where I saw him and I just came across him on might have been YouTube when I was looking for some matches or the TV. I was looking for something and he came on in a promo outside in the streets, and I'd never seen him before. And I thought, who is this guy? Just by the way he was dressed, just by the way he looked, and by the way he was talking, by his sound, by his rhythm. I stopped and watched, and I said, this guy has something special. Is he? He's green, but he has something special, and I wish I would have been able to, have something to do with him early on. But he looks like he's going to be fine.
Oh, yeah, he's doing great so far. Awesome, man. Well, we really appreciate you taking time with us, and this has been a really fun conversation. I really appreciate the stories and your insight into, you know, how you look at this crazy world.
Well, man, professional wrestling is just an opinion, and I think so is this crazy world, and I have my opinion about it too, so.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that opinion with us. It means a lot to me, and I know it means a lot to all of us. So.
Well, very cool, guys. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being on.
You got it.
Have a great night.
Party, too.
Oh, man, yeah. Thank you all so much for joining us on Such Good Shoot. This has been a blast.
Hey, real quick.
Yes, please.
Yeah, yes, I just want to plug and tell
everybody.
Yeah,
plug
away.
All your stuff. I forgot the plug spot.
JPWA, Jacob Pritchard Wrestling Academy. Go to our website, please, and check us out if you're even interested in finding out some good videos and how to film stuff. It's JPWrestlingAcademy.com. We have a new class.
Link in the description down below.
Fantastic. We have our new class starting October 4th and goes through December 10th. That's 10 weeks this time. But we have another class starting bright and early in January in 2022. So if you're interested or just want to go check out some really cool stuff on the website, do it, please. JPWrestlingAcademy.com. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Maybe we'll do it again sometime.
Yeah, I'd love to, talk more. This has been a blast.
Have a great night.
You too.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Such Good Shoot. If you are on YouTube, please remember to like, subscribe, and ring that bell icon. Or subscribe to us on your favorite audio catcher. Or finally, if you're on Facebook, leave a comment, like the video, and make sure to share it out to all your friends. Until next time, we have been Such Good Shoot, and have a great day.